while these price reactions have, occurred roughly in the same cadence of previous halvings, that's no indication of future reactions to the halving this time around. And we could see a completely different price reaction that we've never seen before. But there's also a different dynamic at play here.
Get ready to jumpstart your week with the FCAT Crypto Brief, brought to you by Fidelity Center for Applied Technology. Join me, Ryan Stubbe, Director of Bitcoin Mining, alongside our team of experts, Jason Ward, Head of the Blockchain Incubator, Parth Gargava, the DeFi Engineering Lead from Fidelity Labs, and Jack Newrider, Research Associate with Avon Ventures. Every week, we roll up our sleeves and delve into the hottest topics, from blockchain breakthroughs to DeFi revolutions and market happenings. We promise to go deeper than the headlines and deliver insights you can't get just anywhere. Be sure to hit the subscribe button for your weekly dose of crypto commentary. Quick disclaimer, we're here for education, not investment advice. Views expressed are of the hosts, not Fidelity or its affiliates. Crypto's a wild space, highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and is strictly for those with a high risk tolerance. Buckle up, enjoy the ride, and let's dive into what's been happening recently. Today's episode of the podcast is a special edition episode where we're joined by Matt Allen, associate on the Bitcoin mining team at Fidelity Center for Applied Technology. In today's discussion, we're going to talk about what you should know ahead of the upcoming halving and take some live questions from listeners. So stick around for a great discussion. This is a pretty big moment. We're just about 2 days out from the next Bitcoin halving. We're going to do a couple of things today. So we'll start by just going through a basic refresher on the economics of Bitcoin mining. It might be a little repetitive for some, but I think it'll be important to level set as we talk about the impact of the halving on the network. Then we'll talk about the halving itself. Like I said, the impact on miners and the ecosystem more broadly. And then I'll hand it off to Matt to do a historical analysis of the last two halvings we went through, which was in 2020 and 2016, and talk a little bit about what we saw both in terms of price as well as just network hash rate and other behaviors. And then we'll talk about how that data can be extrapolated to impacts of this happening this week. So really high level, when we say Bitcoin mining, it's really the process of validating and settling transactions on the Bitcoin network. And we do this through a computationally intensive process called proof of work using specialized hardware called ASICs, which is stands for application specific integrated circuits, which really refers to the chips inside the machines. But the industry has basically adopted the standard where we call the machine itself an ASIC. And mining, the process of mining has, plays a pretty critical role in the network. The first is acting as a mechanism for new money issuance. And this is probably the most critical element as we talk about the halving. I think we'll talk a little bit about the impact on miner economics. But it's important to understand that, miners, one of the key roles is that they are basically the vehicle for new Bitcoin entering the market or entering into circulation on any given day. The second, when we speak about network decentralization is the fact that miners are, again, settling transactions, basically to help the network achieve consensus on what the state is at any given time. And that removes the need for any central authority to be stepping in to verify and process those transactions like you would require in traditional finance applications. And then the third is also quite important, and that's really around the decentralization of the network, as well as the security of the network, and that they're consuming energy to complete this compute process, and in doing that, making it hard to effectively attack the network and change consensus at any given time. Just a quick review on the economics of mining. So on the revenue side, the revenue that miners are generating is effectively measured by the block reward, right? And within that block, which is the centerpiece, the center circle right here,
And within that block reward, you have really two key pieces. The first is the block subsidy, and the second are the transaction fees that are contained within that block. The block subsidy is the fixed amount of Bitcoin, newly minted Bitcoin, that the miners are getting paid for mining that block. And that is the piece of the revenue that the halving impacts, right? It's currently 6.25 Bitcoin. And then this Friday, right? Yeah, this Friday, it'll adjust down to 3.125 Bitcoin, right? So just hang on to that. And then as we think about overall, you know, revenue, we basically take that the miner's hash rate and then divide that by the network's, you know, global hash rate and multiply that by whatever the block reward is at that point in time. And that's their revenue. It's important to note, of course, that this revenue is denominated in Bitcoin because the transaction fees that they're collecting are denominated in Bitcoin, as is the block subsidy, which again is newly minted Bitcoin coming out of the Coinbase and being put into circulation. On the cost side, you know, two big costs. The first cost, of course, is, you know, on the CapEx side, which is the purchase of the hardware. And of course, any infrastructure costs to run the hardware, whether you're building a data center or, you know, hosting, you know, at a third party facility. That's really, you know, what that is meant to represent. And then the largest cost for miners on an ongoing basis by far is the cost of electricity, given the energy intensive nature of proof of work. And so that is the largest and can be somewhat variable cost that miners face. But as you know, standalone businesses that are becoming increasingly mature, there's of course taxes and insurance and pool fees, as well as other you know costs of doing business. And you know, given the competition within the mining space, you know, emphasis on cost reduction or cost efficiency is really what makes the difference between an operation that's going out of business and an operation that's going to thrive. And those small tweaks can I guess to the layperson would seem you know, not significant, but they can really make all of the difference in terms of the miner's profitability. So the halving. So there's a lot of hype. You know, I was reading an article on CNBC this morning about, you know, what the impacts of the halving will be. And it's really funny to me because the halving has become, you know, a celebrated event, particularly amongst, you know, the Bitcoin maximalists or the crypto maximalists or people who are really paying very close attention to this space in general. But when you think about it in the event itself and how it technically works, it's actually probably one of the most boring things that happened in Bitcoin. Important, but boring, right? And when we say the halving, we're really referring to basically a, you know, technical feature that's, you know, pre-programmed into the protocol that every 210,000 blocks, which happens to be every 4 years, if you use that 10 minute block time, the block subsidy, right? So the amount of newly minted Bitcoin getting paid out to miners for mining blocks is cut in half. So when the Bitcoin network first launched, that subsidy was 50 newly minted Bitcoin. And over the last several years, or since the launch of the network, we've seen three halvings that have successfully happened. The first was in 2012, which brought the reward down to 25 Bitcoin. The second is in 16 to 12.5. And the third happened in May of 2020. And that was 6.25. It reduced it to 6.25 Bitcoin. And that brings us to today, right? So the fourth halving is expected to occur on the 19th. Although it's like right on the cusp, it could be on the 20th. It's like, you know, 11:30 at night. Effectively, that will reduce the rewards for mining a block down to 3.125 Bitcoin, right? And this is why this gets so much visibility, is because that will have a really profound impact on the dynamics of the network, starting with the miners. What it means in plain terms is that every single day there's going to be 450 less Bitcoin entering circulation, which is about $28.6 million using the price of 63.5, which was the price that I pulled this morning, right? And so when we think about the supply and demand dynamics of the network, this can have a pretty profound impact, you know, on a medium to long term basis. So why is it important, right? The halving really has, you know, 2 to 3 critical roles in the network, depending on how you look at it. The first is around inflation, right? So basically by decreasing the block subsidy, you're also decreasing the rate at which new Bitcoins are entering circulation or are being minted. Right. And what this is intended to do is mimic, you know, the scarcity of precious metals like gold, in a way that, you know, replicates their deflationary characteristics. And that's, you know, the basis of why you hear a lot of people say that Bitcoin is the equivalent to digital gold. This is basically meant to counteract inflation and preserve and bolster the value of Bitcoin over time, right? And so earlier when I said, remember that it's about new money issuance, that is absolutely one of the core pillars in the role of miners in the network and the long-term sustainability of the network. The second is around security, right? The idea here, and we talk about this a lot in other crypto contexts, particularly in DeFi, is about bootstrapping the network, right? So early on, the subsidy for mining new blocks was really significant. It was a lot of Bitcoin. And over time, that's intended to trail off to shift the incentive structure of miners from, you know, basically what's coming out of the treasury of the network, even though it's probably not the right word to use, to, you know, transaction fees, which is going to, you know, more closely mimic and be, you know, align incentives to what's actually happening on the network. And we'll talk about this in a little bit more detail, because there's some big questions here as to whether transaction fees will actually be able to step in and fill this role as the subsidy gets lower. But again, it's really about the long-term growth and sustainability of the network. As we kind of, you know, adoption increases and additional use cases begin to come into play. And so, yeah, so that's the security side of it. And then the second is really just, or the third rather, is really just about decentralization. And that has a lot to do with, you know, where the coins are coming from and who they're going to, right? Mining in general is a fairly decentralized process, although there are some that would argue that there's too much centralization happening right now, just given the consolidation in the industry and with the proliferation of mining pools, with certain pools having, you know, outsized market shares and thus influence over the network. In general, when you compare it to centralized infrastructure, it's more decentralized, right? But one aspect of the current, you know, the current process is in mining the blocks, the newly minted block subsidy or the newly minted coins are going to the miners and only to the miners until they choose to sell them. And Matt's going to talk a little bit more about the flow of funds and the impact that that has on the market dynamics. But it's important to understand that they are the conduit for newly minted coins coming into circulation. And over time, the idea is to kind of de-emphasize that, right? And in kind of de-emphasizing that role that they play, you know, hopefully it'll lead to increased decentralization within the network. So let's talk about the economic impact. And I've talked a little bit about this, but what happens when your revenue, you know, effectively gets cut in half, right? So of course, you know, if you're a user of the network, if you were to broadcast a transaction on Saturday after the halving happens, you're probably not gonna really notice any difference, right? There's no impact to the users of the network or people that are holding Bitcoin and wallets. The most immediate impact is the financial impact on the miners, because again, the block subsidy right now and historically has largely been, you know, the lion's share of their revenue and their income. And so when you think about this revenue that's denominated in Bitcoin and these costs that are denominated in USD, really one of two things needs to happen in order for the network to maintain its, you know, its equilibrium, right? The first is, of course, that the Bitcoin price increases in a way that offsets the loss in the number of units that you're receiving to mine that particular block. And this is, I think, where the conflation between a technical network event and a market event tends to occur, because historically we've seen a significant price increase coming out of the last several, you know, the last three halvings, really. And of course, one could argue that the conditions, and we'll talk a little bit about the network conditions, are different now. But nonetheless, it gets people excited, because you normally see, you know, the price of Bitcoin test all-time highs following a halving event, right? market. And basically, you know, what we're saying here is, you know, price would need to increase and, you know, in order to offset that. The second, of course, is that over time, transaction fees need to become a bigger part of the block reward for miners. And, you know, I think this is where we probably have the biggest kind of long-term ideological question for the network. And then, of course, some miners that are running older, less efficient hardware and that haven't been able to reinvest in the newest, most efficient generation of hardware or don't have access to competitive power rates will have to turn off, right? And so I think, and Matt will talk a little bit about what we see in terms of hash rate trends pre and post halving, but it's likely that we will see some decrease in hash rate, possible difficulty adjustment down temporarily. We expect that to be a very, very short-term condition this time around, certainly far more dampened than what we've seen in previous halvings. And there's a number of reasons for that. So the question really is, and the question that most of the kind of core Bitcoin maxis are asking themselves is, and really just everyone who's you know, interested in the future of the Bitcoin network, is, can transaction fees fill the gap? And the short answer is, I mean, the answer using the current conditions is likely no, right? And that is because historically less than 5% of the block reward is the overall, basically the overall revenue that they're receiving for mining the block, again, is less than 5% versus the block subsidy, right? However, there have been, you know, periods during increased network activity that have, you know, influenced transaction fees role in the block rewards significantly, right? And, you know, if you follow the space closely, you know that over the last year, there's been a very, very intense debate happening around utility and applications on top of Bitcoin, Bitcoin layer twos, tokenization on Bitcoin, NFTs, and the recent, you know, rise of the Ordinal protocol and other Bitcoin-based token standards have kind of proved that there could be a path here if we want to look at, you know, all use cases for Bitcoin beyond that store of value, that digital gold, and beyond medium of exchange to actually bring more, it's going out on a whim here, but more Ethereum-like capabilities into Bitcoin so that you can have more network activity, thus have higher transaction, you know, more volume and higher transaction fees, which could potentially set a path for transaction fees to play a much larger role in the balance of mining economics moving forward, right? And I'll just point to 2024, or, you know, really the period between Jan of 2023 and Jan of 2024. Those spikes are, you know, largely attributed, particularly that early spike, are largely attributed to Ordinal activity. The recent, you know, could probably be attributed to, you know, Ordinal BRC20 activity, as well as increased network activity just around the recent bull run, right? But network, the point here is that network volume, network activity matters significantly and will play an increasingly significant role as we move forward, into this happening, but it's going to be more and more important as we move forward into others. So there is an interesting question. Given the trend of increasing mining costs and the decreasing reward subsidy, is it fair to expect a drop in interest to do the mining? If yes, would we eventually impact the value of Bitcoin negatively? So this is an interesting question. I think, you know, it's important to highlight kind of the self-leveling nature of all of this, right? And kind of just the fundamentals of the network. As the profitability in Bitcoin terms goes down historically, increases in price have offset that to make the process of mining still a very profitable economic endeavor. Right. And so I think the key to highlight here is there's a lot of variables that need to be taken into account to understand, you know, how hash rate, which is basically a function of how many people are mining and how much they're investing into the space, will react to these variables. Right. So I think on the near term basis, I think the answer is no. I think we're continuing to press all time highs in terms of hash rate, which on the back end means that miners are investing millions and billions of dollars in infrastructure to be able to support this process, right? And I think, and this kind of speaks to this slide, it really is about the maturation of the industry, where you now have, you've had billions of dollars of capital move into the space to build out the infrastructure to mine Bitcoin, right? And that was done kind of with the assumption that this halving would happen. And I think, you know, as we look forward, the you know, I would assume one of the variables that's baked into many people's, you know, assumption, and it's certainly baked into ours in terms of how they model revenue, is that Bitcoin will appreciate, right, to self level. And if it doesn't, then the network will correct for that. You'll see less profitable machines come offline, and you know, the hash rate will come down and the difficulty will come down. And again, it's pretty incredible how it maintains equilibrium kind of at a high level. The other kind of quick thought I have on this long-term, on a long-term basis, you know, I think the last halving event that will get us basically to zero will be 2140, right? So it's over 100, it's over 100 years out. A lot's going to change in 100 years, right? But even if you assumed not a lot changed in 100 years, there's a really interesting kind of theme that's emerging in terms of some of the more cutting edge research and development being done around hardware and energy efficient chips. And when I say cutting edge, it's bleeding edge, right? Where you could potentially see a pretty systemic shift in the industry, where it's less around large commercial industrial operators and more decentralized over time, as that subsidy goes down, right? And I'm thinking like everyone has a miner that, you know, like their cable box is a miner, or they have some sort of box sitting in their house on their dresser that's actually mining on the network, right? That's people, again, there's no way to know that that's with any degree of certainty that's going to be what happens over time. But it's interesting, you know, to at least as an academic exercise to think about that, and what that could mean for the function and the decentralization of the network.
Right. I would also add, you know, you kind of touched on it, but I think it's important to really highlight in explicit terms that if you are the lowest cost producer of Bitcoin, assuming a non-zero Bitcoin price, you will always be profitable, right? Because the less efficient miners will turn off, leave the network, difficulty will adjust back down, therefore, you know, increasing your own profitability. And so I think that's really led to a proliferation of like different strategies to use wasted energy or less desirable energy that's not wanted by another user, because that's really where the profitability from mining comes from.
I spoke to the industry, but let's talk a little bit about ETP, right? Because that's what everyone's thinking about. The ETP is probably the singular biggest wild card as we head into this halving, particularly because we don't. It has significantly impacted the supply demand balance of the network as we head into the halving, right? And so typically, we don't start from an near all-time high level as we're heading into a halving event where we are now, right? And so when we talk about extrapolating, you know, future price movements, you know, I think we're going to use a little bit of caution just because this is a sizable variable that never existed before. But, you know, nonetheless, that demand on an ongoing basis will certainly have an impact on the network as we move forward after the halving occurs. Again, you know, if we continue to see persistent demand on the ETF products from retail and institutional investors, one could imagine a scenario where, you know, you're going to continue to see price increase, again, because there will be less supply free floating on the market, certainly coming from miners. And then Matt and I were reflecting on this a bit. It's wild how much has changed in 4 years, which is why I kind of scoff when people try and you know, hypothesize what's going to happen in 100 years from now with the network. When the last halving happened, mining in China was still legal, right? And they controlled a huge percentage of the network hash rate. Since then, of course, there's been a ban. As we now know, there's still quite a bit of mining activity happening in China, but officially it's been banned. And what that's led to is a greater geographic distribution of miners, you know, in different regions, particularly in the United States. Our hash rate has grown fairly consistently in that since that Chinese ban, and particularly in regions like Texas. But we're also seeing an increase in Latin America, as well as areas of the Middle East. And what's really interesting about that, particularly as it relates to hash rate and those cost inputs to operate that hash rate, is the economics of running these operations globally in these different areas, varies very, very significantly. For example, if I'm plugging in my miner in, Texas, with an ERCOT using wind energy, the economics and what I'm paying for that power look very different than if I'm connecting behind the meter in a hydro dam in Nigeria, right? And so I think what's on a long-term basis, as we think about how these halving events will affect hash rate, we need to take this decentralization into consideration, because again, it directly impacts the operational realities around this decentralization will directly impact how reactive hash rate is to these types of events moving forward. I think that's all I had. So Matt, do you want to jump into some of the quantitative stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the first thing, given that we both work in mining and failure, that we want to look at here is how network hash rate reacts to the halving. I think, Ryan, you alluded to this a little bit, but, if we look back at the 2020 halving, we can see a decline in hash rate in the, late February of 2020. And just for note, the halving occurred in May of 2020, kind of driven by price jitters and concerns, potentially around the outbreak of COVID-19, some profit taking ahead of the halving. However, once the wet season in China really kicked off in the late spring, that hash rate came right back online, right up until the halving. And then finally, when the halving finally occurred on May 10th, that hash rate, or 15% of the total network hash rate, became unprofitable, shut off their machines, turned off. The operations were no longer making money. They were actually losing money on an ongoing basis. Now, an important note that's not on the bottom here is that May of 2020 was also the release of a new machine by Bitmain called the S19. It was a much more efficient machine than previous machines on the network. And even at these Bitcoin price levels, hash rate levels, and post-halving, was still profitable. So at most power rates. So that's why you see, right after the halving, you start to see a rebound in this hash rate. And even by July of that year, so two months later, network hash rate recovers, reaches all-time highs again, even with flat Bitcoin price post-halving. That hash rate then continues to grow over the summer into the fall. Now this, again, as Ryan noted, most of the hash rate at the time was still located in China. And so when the wet season ends in China, power rates become much more expensive, there's less stranded energy, and therefore a lot of miners start to turn off. And that's what you see in the fall, even as Bitcoin price, really starts to take off. And as that price starts to take off, you then start to see profitability increase in the network. So even mining at a higher rate of power, more expensive power, miners start to turn back on and follow that price upwards because they're being compensated in a form of a higher Bitcoin price. So now I think we move on to the discussion that everyone likes to talk about surrounding halvings, which is price reactions. We're looking at the 2016 halving and 2020 halving 1 year price reactions indexed to the day of the halving. So we look at 2016 starting at 0%. 1 year later, you have a 300% return in Bitcoin terms, or 3x in price. Really starting that bull run, roughly 6 months post-halving. You look at 2020, again, similar sort of reaction around 6 months post-halving. You start to see this massive bull run in Bitcoin price, resulting in 6x returns a year later. So I think everyone likes to kind of discuss and extrapolate this forward. Is this going to happen again? Is it all supply shock, right? Like, what is price going to do after this halving? And I think Ryan did a great job of highlighting how things are very different this time around. These indexes at zero at the beginning of both of these halvings, Bitcoin was in the doldrums leading to these halvings. It was nowhere near all-time highs for the time. That also being said, like, the supply increase from, or decrease from 6.25 to 3.125 is significantly different from a supply decrease of 12 Bitcoin per block to 6.25. So it's all to say, while these price reactions have, occurred roughly in the same cadence of previous halvings, that's no indication of future reactions to the halving this time around. And we could see a completely different price reaction that we've never seen before. But there's also a different dynamic at play here, which I think both these charts beg the question of, why is the price reaction 6 months post-halving? And to answer that question, I think we need to discuss in a little bit more detail the actual network supply model of Bitcoin. So I think everyone is now well aware that miners, you know, search for blocks. Upon finding a valid block, they're rewarded the block subsidy and transaction fees. That current block subsidy is 6.25. You know, changed it to 3.125 this Friday. And transaction fees are variable based on demand for blocks based on the network. However, that net new Bitcoin doesn't actually hit, you know, the circulating supply right away, right? The block subsidy is sent to the mining pool, which is a, you know, a group of miners all participating, pooling their hash rate together to smooth out their returns and their profitability. That mining pool then distributes the Bitcoin to the miner on a 24-hour basis. So if a mining pool has one exahash, miner A has 10 petahash, they have 10% of that pool. They receive 10% of, you know, the hash rate rewards in that pool. So it's distributed on a pro rata basis. But this is where the key distinction lies. At that point, the miner now has a key decision. They can either hold that Bitcoin on their balance sheet so it never hits the circulating supply, or they can transfer it to an exchange, thereby, you know, introducing net new Bitcoin to the network and increasing the supply, and in exchange receive fiat, you know, whether that is to pay their expenses or just to take profits. So that's all to say, you know, if the halving occurs today, miners are not selling any of the Bitcoin on their balance sheet. Tomorrow, still not selling any of the Bitcoin on their balance sheet. There's no change to supply. However, if miners are selling 100% of the Bitcoin that they received in their mining pool, and tomorrow after the halving, or Saturday in this case, after the halving, they're still selling 100% of the Bitcoin that they received in the mining pool, then there's a 50% reduction in net new circulating supply. So it's important to look at this metric, I think, on an ongoing basis to kind of get a sense of, you know, what the actual net new available Bitcoin is. And so if we look at these miner flows to exchanges throughout the previous halving on the 2020 cycle, you can see, you know, relatively normalized line leading up to March 2020 ahead of the halving, right? Like, you could assume that this is roughly the inflation rate for miners selling their Bitcoin holdings and contributing net new Bitcoin supply to the network. You then kind of see a decline in Bitcoin price where some miners decide it's no longer a good time for them to sell. And then a bit of forced selling ahead of the halving, right? Miners are trying to cover their costs. They're trying to make sure that they are able to cover their costs immediately post-halving in the future, especially if they're running less efficient machines. And that's where you see these big spikes leading up to the halving. But net, and again, just remember that this is net new Bitcoin supply hitting the market. Then the halving occurs in May of 2020, and you see, you know, the second largest spike on this chart, which is really all of the unprofitable miners are trying to sell their Bitcoin, either take the profit or sell their Bitcoin to cover their costs and hope that Bitcoin price, you know, recovers post-halving and they can keep mining profitably. This is just kind of a bridge the gap in between. So again, you know, the halving occurs, you see this big spike of net new Bitcoin on the network. Price stays relatively flat. So new supply is coming on, price is relatively flat. Then throughout the summer, you kind of see, you know, more spikes as miners are trying to either take their profits, cover their costs with this flat Bitcoin price and reduce Bitcoin revenue. And it's not until, you know, early fall, you know, September that you start to see this net new supply kind of normalize at a much lower rate than it was previously. And interesting enough, this is right about the time when you start to see a bull run in Bitcoin price. So obviously correlation is not causation, but in this case, it's a very high correlation to the delay in miners, you know, delay like selling their Bitcoin holdings and decreasing the actual net new supply on a daily basis to the Bitcoin network, and the increase in Bitcoin price following a halving event. And then I'll just note at the end here, as you see these larger spikes as Bitcoin price runs up, is most certainly miners profit taking, right? They've been holding on to this balance sheet throughout the halving event. They start to see price run up. They want to realize that those gains and those profits. So as we think about the potential impact of this halving on the Bitcoin network, Ryan noted, you know, a lot has changed. Bitcoin network looks almost nothing like it did 4 years ago, especially from a miner's perspective. 4 years ago, most of the Bitcoin network was running Bitmain S9s, which is the most popular miner at the time. That has largely changed. You know, there are now a large amount of MicroBT machines in the market. There are different strategies of, you know, running really cheap power with less efficient machines. running, you know, more average power rates for the Bitcoin network with the most efficient machines in the network. And there are more manufacturers as well. So that's all to say, there are a lot of different machines on the network itself. And so a lot of different profitability rates, you know, assuming an average power rate. We can see that 26% of the Bitcoin network is still mining with the S19j Pro. Now, that's a machine that was released by Bitmain in 2021. You know, it's 3 years old. It's an efficient machine. It's a great machine, but it's certainly not the most efficient machine on the market. Same it goes with the S19. Great machine, you know, but over 30 joules per terahash, which for reference, the most efficient machine in the market today is running 17 joules per terahash. It's not the most efficient machine in the market, but the supply has clearly just ballooned over the last 4 years, meaning these machines, you know, readily available and profitable at the same time. The S19 XP is an upgrade to this machine that is water-cooled, so significantly more efficient and definitely makes up a large portion of the network. However, I would call attention to the M20S. This is a machine that, by MicroBT, that is certainly nowhere near their most efficient machine on the market today. And actually, if the halving were to occur right now, these machines would not be profitable. The same goes for the S17 by Bitmain, the M32, the 1066, and as I mentioned, the S9, right? S9s are a machine that have been mining on the Bitcoin network ever since the introduction of ASICs. And there are still machines in the network mining with S9s. There are miners on the network today mining with S9s. However, these machines at current levels will most likely be unprofitable. So just to kind of speak to that, you know, idea a bit more, each machine you can calculate based on its hash rate and power draw and an assumed $50 per megawatt hour power price, using the hash price or the miner revenue today, what the break-even power price for these machines will be. So an S19J Pro is profitable at $73 per megawatt hour and below. You know, the retail rate for power is 8 to 12 cents or $80 to $120 a megawatt hour. So, you know, you plug this machine into your apartment in Boston, you're not going to be making any money, you're going to be losing money. But most Bitcoin miners are using industrial rates, and so the average is roughly $50 a megawatt hour. So this machine is still very profitable. However, if you look at some of these other older machines, right, like the S9, $22 a megawatt hour power, almost certainly no one is receiving that rate unless you're using completely stranded, completely unwanted power. And so, you know, more than likely, all of these machines will leave the network immediately post-halving. And so if you total up all of these hash rates for all these machines that are no longer going to be profitable, roughly 15% of network hash rate would be unprofitable today if the halving occurred. So that's all to say, as we look ahead at what we expect hash rate to do post-halving, we expect 15% will shut off almost immediately. However, there are, you know, new very, very efficient machines that have been released in the past couple of months. The S21 is the most efficient, and that machine is already on the network. It's roughly 3% of network hash rate. We expect these efficient machines will start to really overtake the less efficient machines. And by early summer, if not earlier, network hash rate will again be reaching all-time highs. And then at the end of the year, we expect network hash rate to really be between 681 and 917, which is, of course, a wide range. So we expect that while the halving will, you know, immediately kind of remove some of the less profitable miners from the network, they will sub out those less efficient machines for more efficient and actual profitable machines. So I'll pause there for any questions that we may have. Let's see.
Thanks, Matt. Yeah, we there's a couple of questions around the supply. So there's particularly a question around understanding the total BTC originated as compared to the current supply and circulation. Essentially, how much BTC is withheld by miners at a given time. You want to, so I think it's worth noting that it's just shy of like 94% of the 21 million have already been mined into existence. Of that, you know, quote unquote circulating supply, there's different figures on this, but as much as, like, you know, 4 million, 5 million could be lost forever or, you know, at least haven't moved in the last 10 years. So that's an important consideration as well. But Matt, with regard to the publics and how much Bitcoin the miners are holding, you want to speak to this? Because I know you spent a lot of time looking at the treasury management strategies of the largest miners.
Yeah, definitely. I think another important distinction this time around is that one could imply that leading up to the 2020 halving, large miners were holding Bitcoin on their balance sheet, staking mines, right? You see these large spikes in Bitcoin sent to exchanges. That's Bitcoin that was accumulated on the balance sheet by miners. That's not any one miner, you know, mining 1,000 Bitcoin a day and sending it all to exchanges. That's different this time around. You know, 2021 or 2022 through 2023, mining economics were really, really challenging. So most miners were actually selling more Bitcoin than they mined on a monthly basis. You know, if you look at the publics, their like share of Bitcoin mined versus Bitcoin sold, it's over 100% every month for nearly every public miner. You know, there are a few notable exceptions. However, most miners do not have a large treasury of Bitcoin. And so that's all to say this time around, like you might not see these large spikes of miners liquidating their Bitcoin treasury because it's just not available. That Bitcoin has already been sold off. And I think that's an interesting distinction. You know, if that's really what caused this run up 6 months later, that net new supply shock will be felt earlier this time around, it would be my assumption.
There is a question regarding immersion cooling in mining applications. I can take this one. So it specifically asks if it impacts the efficiency. You know, based on what we've seen, some of the most efficient machines in terms of joules per terahash, right? So that's joule of energy, the amount of joules of energy consumed to produce one terahash are immersion units. So yes, I mean, as we think about immersion applications and those that becoming more prevalent moving forward, and it certainly is becoming more prevalent currently, we would expect that that will help develop, you know, more efficient machines. As we think about those machines in the context of the global hash rate, it's also important to point out that immersion applications generally enable you to overclock the machine, right? And what I mean by that is you're essentially pushing more energy into the machine, and it's able to produce more, more terahash per second, more hash rate at any given time, right? And so when you think about spending $1 million on, you know, a lot of ASICs, you're able to basically, you know, optimize or you know, extract additional value by, you know, producing more hash rate than what those machines, you know, what their nameplate hash rate is, right? So there is a very real impact on some of the dynamics which we're talking about here, as far as immersion applications go. And we generally believe, you know, it, of course, is dependent upon the operating environment, but immersion will become more and more prevalent. And then there's another question around regulation in the United States. And a second question around what the effects of the federal government looking into mining's power usage will be. I think this is regulation and in the US and the relationship to digital assets broadly is one of the biggest open questions. As we think about mining specifically, of course, we saw that the emergency study of all of the mining activity and energy consumption in the US. But that got put on hold by a Texas judge. I think and this is my opinion, I think the spirit of at face value of what that was looking to accomplish is something that we will over time probably need. But the motivations for doing that emergency survey are definitely being called into question, and I think rightfully so. It's important to call out that in certain parts of the country, particularly in Texas, is a good case study for this. These mining operators are becoming such large industrial loads that they're becoming systemically important to the grid itself. Right. And as that continues to happen in other places, it is likely that we will see more emphasis around trying to understand what these loads are and what their impact is on the power pricing, on the grid stability. And I think it's important to note that there's some assumptions that that is going to be a largely negative story. But I would kind of dispute that. In that, you know, I think there's with some data, you'd actually see some really positive impacts on the grid. I don't know, Matt, do you have anything to add here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the first thing I would add is that ERCOT has come out and said publicly that Bitcoin miners have a very net positive effect on the grid itself, helping to stabilize and provide excess power in times of, you know, grid events and grid reserve shortage. The other thing I would add is just an aside, I think an anecdote related to that is that there's a large like Telegram chat, essentially, of the large miners that operate in Texas. And every time that ERCOT starts to expect that they will experience a shortage in grid reserves, they just text in Telegram chat and say, hey, Bitcoin miners, like, please be ready to curtail. Like, we're expecting that, you know, we're going to be running short on reserves tomorrow due to, you know, low wind, high grid demand. And all these miners, like, it's in their economic interests and in their, you know, operating interests to do so and do so on, you know, with the best intentions.
I think probably we'll leave it there and wrap. But yeah, we're all eyes on the halving. And, you know, hopefully it's a thoroughly boring event and nothing major happens.
Crypto as an asset class is highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and is for investors with a high risk tolerance. Crypto may also be more susceptible to market manipulation than securities. Crypto is not insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation or the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. Investors in crypto do not benefit from the same regulatory protections applicable to registered securities. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. This podcast was produced by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, also known as FCAT. FCAT does not offer digital assets nor provide clearing or custody of such assets. It is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide tax, legal, insurance, or investment advice, and should not be construed as an offer to sell, a solicitation of an offer to buy, or a recommendation for any security or other asset by any Fidelity entity or third party. Views expressed are as of the date indicated, based on the information available at the time, and may change based on market or other conditions. Unless otherwise noted, the opinions provided are those of the authors and not necessarily those of Fidelity Investments or its affiliates. Fidelity does not assume any duty to update any of the information. Fidelity and any other third parties mentioned in the podcast are independent entities and are not affiliated. Mentioning them does not suggest a recommendation or endorsement by Fidelity. This information is not intended for distribution to or use by any person or entity in any jurisdiction or country where such distribution would or use would be contrary to local law or regulation. Persons accessing this information are required to inform themselves about and observe such restrictions. Third-party trademarks appearing herein are the property of their respective owners. All others are the property of FMR LLC. Copyright 2024 FMR LLC. All rights reserved. 10